But the way I got to meet him was me and Jason basically would run around listening to tapes all the time. I hear this one tape and I said, Jason, you gotta hear this tape. Jason hears, he says, find that guy, you know? So, of course, it takes me at least 3 or 4 phone calls to get through. And I didn't want to tell him why I was calling because I thought he might say no. So I just kept saying, this is Pierre, and I'm a friend of Bill W's, and if you would give me a call back, and he would call back, and I wouldn't be there. And we went back and forth, and finally I got in touch with him. As soon as I asked him what we wanted him to come to Atlanta to speak, he said, no problem, yes. And I was all happy. Then he said, well, this is you all's first one, huh? I said, yeah. And he says, how's registration going? And I know it's an honest program, and I'm thinking, the last tape I heard from him, he's at the International AA with 60,000 people. It's a year and a half into our program, and we got 37 registrations, you know. I'm like, well, we're doing pretty good, you know. I said, we're expecting more, though. And, you know, he was so nice about it. Only thing he talked about was, I know how hard it is to do that job. I know how hard it is to do a roundup. I don't care how many people are there. I want to be there because you've asked, and I need to be there. Then the next time I called back, only thing he talked about was he had went through treatment here in Atlanta before he got, you know, when he got sober here. And he set up a way that we could have people that were actually in treatment programs here able to come to the roundup with a, you know, a little fun thing here so that they would be able to come if they didn't have money. And I thought that was so nice that here I was worried about if he would want to come. And not only did he want to come, he didn't care who was here. He wanted to make sure that other people who didn't have an opportunity to be at the roundup could come. So I thought that said a lot about him. And with that, I give you Michael.
Honest introduction, wasn't it? My name is Michael, and I'm an alcoholic. And since my sobriety was really born in Texas, I need to tell you my sobriety date right up front. There's a saying in Texas, if you don't give your sobriety date, you may not have one. Mine is September 26th, 1988, and for that I'm extremely grateful. This is a program of ego deflation and depth, isn't it? That was fabulous. Thank you. I feel like I should have a long blue robe on, but I don't have one. I checked upstairs. But if a big song comes on, the rapture may just come over me, and who knows what happens after that point. I want to thank the committee for inviting me out here. Alcoholics Anonymous has never said no to me. Whenever I've needed them, they've been there. And so because of that, when they ask me to do something, I try as much as I can to help them back out. Because without y'all, I wouldn't be here at all. I also want to tell you that I've gotten some wonderful Southern hospitality while I've been down here. I want to thank you all very much. I got Southern hospitality and then some, and it's been great, and thank you. Don't go there. Do not go there. You know, before I talk, I always like to put in some disqualifiers, and there's a couple of them. The first one I want to tell you is that there are some things I may say that are probably my opinion, and if there's something that I say that you and your sponsor can't reconcile with the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, it is my opinion. Please throw it away. Opinions can get people drunk. The second thing I need to tell you is my drug of choice is whatever you had the most of. If that was gin and tonic, that'd be fine. If that was tequila and Diet Dr. Pepper, that'd be okay. If that was cocaine, if that was morphine, if that was XKTEY, that was fine too. What I have learned, though, is that Alcoholics Anonymous is my treatment of choice. I get everything I need right here. My sponsor assures me that I could go to a 12-step program for every problem I have. I would not have time to work because I'd be going to meetings all the time. I refuse to give up a few things. I'm not going to give up caffeine. I'm not going to give up shopping. And then there's one other thing. I'm not going to give that up either. The last thing I want to say, and probably the most important thing I'll say all night, at least for me, is that Alcoholics Anonymous has forever changed my life. It's given me a life I didn't know I wanted, and one that I truly most of the time don't deserve. And I thank you for that. You know, they say we're supposed to share in a general way what it used to be like, what happened, and what we're like now. And I'll try to do that to the best of my ability. I was born in a small town in mid-eastern Ohio. And I was born to a group of parents, kind of like the parents we've heard about all weekend from the other speakers. My parents probably weren't ready for me then. They're still not ready for me now most of the time. I feel like I was dropped in from another planet. What I remember about that household is it was partially Irish Catholic like Joe's and partially Italian Catholic. So there was lots of alcohol in our house. It was funny. I was probably in college before I realized that most families didn't buy 20 cases of Rolling Rock at a time. And they didn't buy bourbon in, you know, half in cartons of half gallons. I mean, that's not the way it happened. Alcohol was part of every part of our life. If there was a wedding, if there was a funeral, if there was something happening, there was alcohol involved. And I bring that up because I don't know if my parents are alcoholics. I know that there were some things that happened in that house that alcoholism can explain, but there may be other explanations as well. What I know today is that my parents did the absolute best with what they knew. To believe otherwise, I would think they would have to wait till us kids go to bed and sit at the table and say, how can we fuck them up tomorrow? You know, I know my parents didn't do that. My parents are were then the age I am now, trying to raise four kids, have a couple jobs, go out and have a good time every now and then, and they really did the best they could. I mean, I know sometimes if I can't get a workout and a manicure in the same day, I'm pissed off, and, you know, here they are trying to raise kids, and I applaud them, their effort. I learned from an early age, though, to become a human doing instead of a human being. I found out that when I did positive things at home, I got positive reinforcement. And so because of that, I did as many things as I possibly could. If I was in the summer reading book club, I would read 200 books and all the rest of the kids would read like 8. And if I was in swimming class, I'd have to be at the top of my form. And I would just do all those things because that's the only way I knew how to get attention with those other kids around. Now, it's funny, that's the way I remember it. When I get to talk to my brothers and sisters now, which is a gift that the program has given me back, they remember it totally different, but that's the way I remember it. When I was 16 years old, I decided to come out to my parents, and that was not a very popular thing to do back then. I don't want to make it sound like I was blazing a trail. They actually happened to find some notes between me and my boyfriend that left very little to the imagination. And what happened, and why I bring it up is because I need to tell you what happened to that family that I lived in. When you have a family that doesn't have a whole lot of other skills, and you put tragedy or you put adversity into it, they react by going deeper into their alcoholism. And I remember we all drank a lot. It was a very painful and unhappy time at home. The program of Alcoholics Anonymous has helped me with that because it's let me know what happened. And then what happened was simple fear. This young, bright, cheerful son of theirs was choosing a path that they knew nothing about except pain. I mean, because the people that are in this room now, the gay people that we are today, it's not the gay people that people used to be back then. And you know, as a patriotic little kid, if I would have told them I was going to go off to the Vietnam War, they would be just as frightened and therefore just as angry as they were. They did tell me something, though, then at that time that came back to become one of my mantras, and what that was, you can do whatever you want, and I guess you can sleep with whoever you want to, but you will make nothing of yourself. Well, you don't give a budding alcoholic that kind of an idea, you know. I mean, of course we're going to have to do something with that. I drank at school, and the reason I drank at school is because it was a little painful to be at school. You know, I mean, you're kind of out, and this is way back then. I mean, this is in the 70s, and they were not very kind to people who were even a little bit effeminate, let alone, like, buzzing back and forth across the rooms. And and so I was the kid that they would knock their books out of their hand and lock me in my locker and stuff like that. And I had a pass key to the high school, and I would do things to get back. Like I would break into the teacher's room and change the answers on their exams. Yeah, many of them did not get into the Ivy League colleges they wanted to because of that. And that is a really difficult amends to make, and I haven't quite figured out how to do it. but I graduated from high school, did very well, went off to college. Before I went to college, I actually was an exchange student in Brazil for 6 months. I don't remember hardly any of that. I remember one thing. They have this alcohol there called cachaça. It's about 140 proof. You drink it with ice and lemon. That's all I knew. I mean, I did go to school one day, and they had me read the Gettysburg Address. That's, I think, all I remember of the entire time I was there, which is unfortunate because it's a beautiful country, and I'd like to go back sometime and visit. But parts of my alcoholism had already started to take over parts of my life. I went off to college, and I decided to make my first geographic at that time just because I had to get out of that house, and they wanted me out of there too. And off I went to Cleveland, Ohio. I went to a school called Case Western Reserve, and I remember freshman orientation was another big drinking experience for me. I had had a half gallon of Jack Daniels, and I drank most of that Jack Daniels, and I smoked a pack of Marlboro cigarettes. And I woke up with a 300-pound woman on top of me naked. And it scared me to death, and I haven't smoked a Marlboro cigarette since then. Scared me to death. Bless her heart. And then she had the audacity to call me a fag around school. I don't know what that was about. College was very fun. I did very well in college. Alcohol was still my friend, and that's what I finally learned. Alcohol was my friend. When I went to college, I was introduced to drugs other than alcohol. My favorite combination was speed and marijuana, simply because if I did the marijuana by itself, I was just kind of stupid and hungry. And when I mixed the speed with it, then I was just kind of stupid and fast. And plus, I could drink well. You know, this says the great obsession of every alcoholic is to find a way that they can drink without any repercussions, and that was it for me. I was just take a lot of speed, and I could drink all night. And I did that many times. I had some relationships during this time, by the way, boyfriends, I think people call them, and they just didn't ever work out. Because, you know, when you drink like I used to drink, you know, you go to the party with one, and in the middle of the party, you forget who you came with. And so you just found another one. And then the first one, the next day, would have this resentment. You know, and I didn't know how to deal with that, so I just kept moving on. And it was a very exciting way to live, put it that way. I graduated from that school, and actually my degree was actually was a dance theater major. And I applied to graduate school, and again, I had to do another geographic because I probably knew every drug dealer and most of the men in Cleveland, so I had to move to another city. And I thought of going to Chicago, but I thought I would definitely fail out in Chicago, and I thought, well, I could go to Dayton, but that's going to any lengths for an education. I didn't do that. So I went to Columbus, Ohio, and I went to Ohio State. Plus, Ohio State had a really great enabler there called my sister, and she was wonderful, and she helped me out when everybody else couldn't, you know, when you need a six-pack of beer or a joint or dinner or something like that. And so I went down to graduate school at Ohio State, and it got better for a little while because I was out of the environment. It's one of the reasons, I think, why they tell us early in sobriety to change our playmates and our play places, because when you're out of that environment and you just don't know the places to go, you kind of behave a little bit for a while. But I'm an alcoholic, and I'm a drug addict, and I have to eventually find those people. After my first year of school, I got... I say I got lonely, but I think it actually was a lower thing than that. I just hadn't met enough people, and I think it was kind of more like horny. So I went out and I started meeting people in the only way I knew how. there was this group of guys that I always thought was kind of fun, so I decided I was going to join their little group. And I should have known that I had to go home with this guy three times before he remembered my name. And his name was Michael. He was pretty. That's about all I can say for him. And again, they started introducing me to the people that I could find more drugs from and more alcohol from, because we did something every weekend. Now, I'm still going to school all this time, and I'm doing actually a little less well than I did when I was in college. And that didn't seem to bother me. The last 2 years of my program were in, actually in the clinics of the university hospitals. And if any of you have ever been in that, you know, all you really have to do is show up and be there and get your work done. And they're happy to have you. And if you're a little drunk on Monday, they don't say too much about it. As long as you get your work done. And I could do that because I had lots of speed. Drugs other than prescription drugs kind of started finding their way in, of course, too. You know, we did ketamine so long ago. I mean, you guys who talk about Special K, you don't even know. You do not even know. I mean, we did it back before. We called it ketamine. We didn't even call it Special K. I thought that was a breakfast cereal. You know, we did what we had to do. Desperate people do desperate things. To coin a phrase. I graduated from graduate school, and they gave me two pieces of paper that were very dangerous. The first is a license to practice medicine and surgery in the state of Ohio, and the second thing was a DEA number. And I was like a kid in the candy store. You know, we'd go flipping through that PDR, and we'd just find things we wanted, and we'd just write prescriptions for everybody, and they'd give me half. Thank you. That was the price of admission. And we just went ripping and tearing through it all. I decided to change places I lived again because it had gotten too warm in Columbus. I would do stupid things while I was there. You know, I had this thing for cheerleaders. I don't know where that came from. And so I was dating two of the cheerleaders on the Ohio State cheerleading squad. And, you know, they told each other. They did, and they both, you know, got mad at me. I would do things like I remember we were coming home from a bar one night, and again, I had done that thing of I'd forgotten who I'd gone with, and the person I'd gone with happened to be my lover at the time, and he was doing lights or something. Because, you know, you always have to date a bartender, a DJ, or a light man. I mean, it's the only way you can do it, because they get their drinks for free. And this is when alcohol had started changing a little bit, because we were driving home when he was yelling at me about having my hand down some guy's pants or something. I don't know what I was doing. And he threw a cigarette at me. I was driving. So I reached out, threw the cigarette away, and backhanded him across the car. So he got into my face, right here into my face. I just leaned out and nearly took off his lip with my teeth. 47 stitches, inside and outside. He had to go to my hospital and say, I don't know how it happened. I got cut, or someone bit me. I can't remember who. So when I like to think about some of the fun things I did drinking, I also have to remember those times as well. Went off to Dallas. And the reason I went to Dallas is I went to do a couple months there. In the early 80s. I don't know if any of you know much about Dallas in the early 80s, but it was booming. The oil business was going strong, banking. I went down there for 2 months and fell in love. People drank like we did. They give you drinks in these great big tall glasses, because in Ohio there's these little tiny glasses, big tall glasses, 3-in-1s and 4-in-1s. It's like, yay. These people know how to drink. It looked like someone's handing you a vase of flowers with alcohol in it. And the boys did lots of drugs, and they were pretty. They actually still are pretty. And I said to all my friends, we're going to Texas. And we loaded up. We looked exactly like the Beverly Hillbillies. We had everything but the rocking chair on the top of that car. And off we go to Texas. And big caravan, 4 hostages, off we go. Well, I came down to Dallas and started living my life all over again. You know, you can pick alcoholic stuff and put them anywhere. But wherever you go, there you are. And I found that to be extremely true. Started partying in a different city. Never really changed. Never really got any better. If we couldn't find drugs, we would just drink all weekend. We could at least find a couple half gallons of Jim Beam, which might get us through the weekend. I would do things like I would put on my scrubs on a night that I wasn't on call and go back to the hospital and steal ketamine out of the medicine cabinet. That was kind of weird. I mean, imagine now if somebody, that you're at work and somebody comes in the middle of the night to visit, to get something from their locker, and all of a sudden goes into the medicine cabinet and leaves. I would find that kind of strange. I didn't think so at the time. It just got to be the point where it was kind of sad. It was really sad. But I didn't know any better. And, you know, none of the people I hung around with knew any better either. We were all in that same boat. We all drank the same way. We all passed out the same way. We all woke up with people we didn't know who they were, in places we don't remember going, with none of our clothes on. That's just what we did. I went out into private practice after I was on staff for a year at the medical center there. And people who understand the way healthcare is financed know that you don't make any money when you're a resident, but when you go out into practice, you start making in a month what you used to make in a year. And because of that, that just meant more money for drugs. And what was already getting to be pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization went a lot faster. And we started buying drugs in large quantities. It's so funny, we always did those little ecstasy runs where we'd go buy 100, and then we're going to make money, and then you eat them all, and then you don't make money, and then you do it again next month. It just never worked out. The people in my life were starting to get, they're just getting tired of me. You know, you can only do it so long to so many people, no matter how much of the disease of alcohol and drug addiction they have or how much they don't have. They can only put up with so much. You can only buy them so many things, take them so many places until they go, it's not all that. It just isn't. And periodically, hostages would escape. I hate that when that happens. I was, it was 1987. My work had gotten very strange because, you know, you get really paranoid when you do a lot of drugs and you think it's any day now you're going to come into work and they're just going to have a little bag packed for you and tell you it's time to go. I would get there and I'd be really hungover and I would have two of my nurses do most of the cases and I'd sit up in my call room because it just got too bad. I would just be too hungover. In 1987, I was dating this fabulous guy. I can't remember his name. And he escaped. He escaped because we had an argument that I really don't remember. You know, there's mornings when you wake up and you're alone in bed and you think, where'd they go? They're probably out there tricking with somebody. And you find them in the front bedroom with the door locked. And you bang on the door and they finally open it, just peeking through the door. And they say those words you hate to hear. You don't even remember what you did last night, do you? You don't remember what you said. You don't remember what you threatened. You don't even remember the knife, do you? And that's where it had taken me. And off he went. Most people don't have IV narcotics in their house. Now, I had some. Now, let me explain this to you. It made perfect sense at the time. I knew it was only a matter of time before I developed the AIDS virus, so I thought I'll just have my little suicide kit all ready. That way I can take care of this myself. So I had this little suicide kit. It had an IV bag and a start kit, all the stuff. It had some sodium pentothal, it had some muscle relaxants, it had some narcotics. It was a perfect little kit. Well, I just popped open that box, and I've tried to go back, especially for my IV drug abuser friends, and try to figure out what happened. What happened that day that didn't happen the day before or 2 weeks later? But I tied up that tourniquet like I was Billie Holiday. And I popped that through my vein, and I chased that for the next 6 months. To those of you who've never done IV drugs, I don't need to tell, I can't tell you. And to those of you who have, I don't need to tell you. When you add IV drugs to what I was doing, you go somewhere really, really fast. Some people die, and some people live. And I just happen to be one of the ones that lived. My behavior got really bizarre. It got really bizarre. I did it around the clock. And I played the little game that all addicts play. I'm not going to do any today. I am not going to do any today. And it's 7 o'clock in the morning and you're at work, and okay, maybe I'll do just a little bit. But I'm not going to do any more until noon. And it's 7:15, you're doing it again. And it's 7:40, you're doing it again. And you play the game all day. Then you go home and you drink and you add other drugs to that. Absolute strangeness started happening. I lost some weight because, you know, when you do drugs, you don't really want to do anything else. You don't want to eat. You don't want to sleep. You don't want to have sex. You don't want to do anything but more. And so that's where I went. I kept doing more. I used to shoot up in the bathroom. I think most physicians do. That ubiquitous hospital bathroom, guardrail, toilet, sink, mirror. I'd stopped looking in the mirror a long time ago. I really had. But I was tied up one day and getting ready to do all that. And I was playing that little game. I can stop whenever I want to. I can stop whenever I want to. This is just a game. I'm just kind of using this for a short period of time. I can stop whenever I want to. And I looked into the mirror that day, playing that little game, and my eyes looked back and they said, "No, you can't. You are mine. You are mine, and I'm going to take you all the way down with me." I don't know if that's the day I said that accidental prayer, the one my friend Marie calls the naked prayer of the alcoholic that just says, "Help me. Just help me. No causes, no conditions, just please." You know, when you ask for help from a higher power, as Cece related the other night, you get some help. It may not be the help you expected, but you get some help, and you get some help quick. The next day, I was putting some little girl to sleep for tubes in her ear. She was probably 2. And she turned really blue. And I didn't know what to do. I just walked to the back of the room and stood there. And one of my nurses came and took care of that. And the patient did fine. I had, the night before, realized that they were going to catch me eventually. So I had track marks in my arm. And, of course, the track mark is in the vein. I thought the track mark was in the skin. So I numbed up my arm and got a bone file, filed down through the tissues to the bone, dressed it, went back to sleep. The next day was Thanksgiving. That was a miserable day. Went to a woman's house who I've been going to for 15 years still. Put her family through absolute hell for a Thanksgiving dinner. And the day after that, well, God started doing for me what I couldn't do for myself. They called me in to do a C-section because I was on call and I was playing that poor, pitiful me. I'm always on call. I have to go back out to work. And being a good little controlling alcoholic, I had my cell phone. I called him and I said to Stephanie, "Stephanie, I need you to go ahead and bring that patient back. I'll be there in a few minutes." And she said, "There's no patient here, but there sure are a lot of people here." And I walked into an intervention at my own hospital. don't know if any of you have ever been in an intervention or if you've ever constructed an intervention. Interventions work only by bringing in the people who agree with the way you want to make the intervention go. So because of it, there was a doctor there and two nurses. That was it. They couldn't invite my boyfriend, even though they had no problems with me being gay. He didn't want the party to stop. Loved my parents to death. He couldn't have invited my parents. They would have said, let's bring him back up to Ohio. We'll love him. He'll be fine. We'll get him out of that environment. Three people. Dr. Tom said to me, we're worried about you may be using IV drugs. You've lost a lot of weight. You look horrible. And I said, well, I've lost so much weight because I'm HIV positive. And he said, that may be true. However, could we still have a urine sample? Well, the HIV came back negative. The urine sample came back with things I don't remember quite taking. It lit up like a Christmas tree. I was on everything but a skateboard. I'm so grateful that the next thing he said to me was actually a couple things. He said, you're not going to have to die. And you're not going to have to do this by yourself. I'm going to be there with you. And for the next 15 years, he's made that promise come true. He's still there. That's why I came here a little late on Friday, because I get to work with him every Friday, and I get to go have a big meeting all day long. It's fabulous. He then said one question. Would you like to leave tonight, or would you like to leave in the morning? I am so grateful to this day that that was the only question I got. I probably would have picked the 1 week with the 2 weekend follow-ups. Or I would have picked the 30-day outpatient program. But they didn't give me that option. They said, clear the stuff out of your locker and get on a plane. Now, see, I thought the problem was really just this narcotic stuff. I didn't realize alcohol was a problem. So I flew down to Atlanta, first class. Drank the whole way. When I got to Anchor Hospital and they said, when was your last drink? I looked at my watch. That probably kept me there another month just for that. And although I can remember all the fun of Alcoholics Anonymous, it was not fun at that point at all. If I remember nothing else, I have to remember that first week where I came down like every other junkie comes down. I had track marks up and down my arm. I had sores in my nose from all the crystal and cocaine I was snorting. I had ulcers in my esophagus from all the alcohol. I looked horrible. I weighed 131 pounds. I weigh 180 pounds now. I didn't get any taller. Okay, you get the idea. Pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization, that's what I was. You could ask the janitor in that place what I was, and he would have said, it looks like a junkie to me. I sweat, and I vomited, and I shook, and I did that for 3 days. And the people there just said, just keep taking some showers, and we'll just keep changing your bedclothes, and they were wonderful. And then one night I got this knock on the door, and they said, it's a come to Jesus meeting. That's interesting. And I met the people of Alcoholics Anonymous for the... first time. And those of you who do that service work, I need to thank you. It's thankless work. But someone was there and they gave their story. And I didn't hear a whole lot of it. Actually, I didn't hear a whole lot for a while. I let the music of Alcoholics Anonymous worship just wash over me long before I heard the words. The laughter and the rest. I learned some stuff in that treatment center. I learned about the disease concept that Cece talked about. It helped me because I was a health professional. It helped me realize that I just have a disease very much like diabetes. It's progressive. It's fatal. It's treatable. And it's treatable in a lot of different ways. Some people change their diet. Some people take pills. Some people have to take their blood sugar every 3 hours and adjust their insulin. And that's how we are. Some of us have to go to meetings every day. Some of us go once a week. Still the same disease. Still kill me if I don't take care of it. I got to go to a little club in Atlanta called Galano. We were working out yesterday, Jeff and I, and somebody told us where to go, and off we go down Amsterdam Walk, and we're pulling down in there, and I'm thinking, this is really familiar. And where that old shoe store is there is used to be the Galano Club. Just hit me. Couldn't talk. I met some wonderful people there. I learned about GAA, whatever that is or is not. I'll never know. I remember the first time I wanted to talk at a straight club. I said to my sponsor, should I tell them I'm gay? And he said, honey, they're going to have to watch you walk up there. They're going to know. I mean, they're alcoholics. They're not stupid. I got to meet people. I got to repopulate my life. That's the best thing treatment did. It got me out of the situation I was in. I stayed there for 4.5, 5 months. I got to meet human beings again. I got to interact with them. I got to talk about things other than me. You know, when you're an alcoholic and drug addict like I was, your boundaries are way out there if you have them at all. And one of the things they do is they put their boundaries in so close that you can touch them. They're like this. You can't even pee for the first 10 days by yourself. And that's exactly what I needed. People say, well, they treat you like a baby. Well, I needed to be treated like a baby. I was one. It was the first time I was on a locked ward that I didn't have a key. Now, I didn't truly get exactly where I was. I kind of did something similar to what Cece did. I went there the second day, and I said to the nurse, I was still a little shaky, and I said, excuse me, is there some place around here, a reputable dry cleaner, so that I can take my cashmere sweaters too? She didn't even look at me. She looked at the nurse beside her and says, this kid has no idea where he is, does he? And I didn't. I got to learn about the lie. I like to call it the lie. Because it's that thing that kept me out there for so long. It's especially prevalent for gay people. You know, the lie that says, if I don't drink, I'll never have sex again. I'll never get laid again. I'll never be funny again. I'll never get to go out again. I'll never get to dance again. I'll never get to do all that stuff again. And it's a lie. I have done all of those things and much more since I've been sober. It's just a lie. I look at it upon it as such. One of the other things they had me do, and I'm so grateful they had me do this, they had us do this little thing where we used to write out our first relapse. What did your first relapse look like? Well, you know, I know what mine looks like. It usually starts with a guy. I don't know about the rest of you. My sponsor makes me talk to everybody who's had a relapse when they come back. We ask them, have you been going to meetings? Have you been doing this? Have you been doing that? And invariably, they talk about a person. A guy, a girl. Things started going great. You know, you get to treatment and you think, you know what? I'm not a fuck-up. I'm just an alcoholic. And about 2 years later, you meet him or her. And you get the car or the house or the job. And you start getting to this thing of, maybe I was just immature back then. I was in the wrong relationship and I had a job that didn't appreciate me. And then next thing you know, you're back out there. So they made us write ours down. Pretty young thing, dancing around, reach over, grab the wrong drink. Off I went. So now when I'm in that situation and there's a pretty young thing and we're dancing around, I know exactly what I'm supposed to watch out for. And I watch out very diligently. When I left that treatment center, my counselor was a very good counselor, and she said, I need to talk to you and I need to tell you something that's very important. You're young, you're gay, you're wealthy, you're a physician, and an anesthesiologist in particular. Your chances of staying sober 5 years are less than 5%. The only thing that could make it worse is you could also be black. I suggest you go back to Dallas and you find yourself a mean, nasty dyke sponsor. All I could find was Jack. He fits most of it. You know, I went back home and I started practicing medicine again. They let you do that once, by the way. And people laugh about people who go back out of the treatment center and go back to bartending or go back to being a waiter. I do that. Every day for each patient, I get this big box of narcotics, things I loved. I work with it every day. I remember the drug is for the patient, not for the doctor. Yeah. I'm very, very careful about every kind of medication I take. I check it all out with another recovering alcoholic first, who also happens to be a physician and a friend. I don't want to get into any of that gray area where I may end up taking something that then causes the desire to drink to come back. Because I have an allergy of the body and a compulsion of the mind, and I can't do anything else when it happens. I met my sponsor actually at Roundup. He talks about it every now and then. When he crashed and burned in Houston, Texas, he was supposed to meet this girl for dinner. And the girl happened to live across the street from me with her new girlfriend. And so when I got back from treatment, and you know, I was not the best neighbor, trust me, when I was drinking, I would see people in the house, we'd have the police come over, we'd have parties and we'd ride up and down the street on a motorcycle and drag. I mean, it was just not the things you do to a small little neighborhood in Dallas, Texas. So they knew I had gotten back from treatment, and they called Jack and they said, there's a friend of ours who's leaving right now to go to an AA meeting at a Roundup, and he has on a blue shirt and he may need your help. And I go to the meeting and this little Yoda-like figure walks up and says, my name's Jack, and if you need to help, some help, if you need some guidance, call me. Again, I'm so grateful that he did. I have a lot of education. I still could not get those steps off that wall and into my life without the help of somebody else. For those of you who sponsor people, you know exactly what I'm talking about. Because my sponsor does many things for me besides just that. He holds the yardstick of my progress. I can't see it. I can see the progress in you. I cannot see it in me. I'm blind to that. It's not given to me. He sees that. So when I start going through some of my stuff again, he says, nope, not as bad as it used to be, not even close. But if you want what we have, you have to go to Endurance to get it. And I have to remember that when I sponsor people. If you want what I have, I'm sorry, you're going to have to do it my way. I look upon it as people going from the East Coast to the West Coast in the 1800s. You know, you hired a guide. There are three ways to go. You could go the northern route, you could go the middle route through Kansas City, you could go the southern route through Fort Worth. And you hired a guide and he took you. Well, if halfway through the middle route you decide you wanted to go the southern route, that's fine, you'll get there. But you need a new guide, because that guide doesn't know how to go that way. If I want what he has, I have to do it his way. And I remember that now with the people I sponsor. And it's not a veil of tears. It's not a veil of tears at all. You know, as Jeff says, lighten up, girl. know? That's what you got to do. You just got to lighten it up. And I had to learn that too. I don't just rely, though, on my sponsor today. I rely on some of the other people in Alcoholics Anonymous. If you don't have friends in AA, I suggest you get some. They're very, very important to have. I probably have 6 or 7 truly good friends in my life. Almost all of them are in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, or the couple don't need to be. They're really strange. They have a glass of wine with dinner, and then they're finished. I don't understand that, but that's the way they do it. Because when you surround yourself with people like that, first of all, they call you on your shit. And secondly, they keep you out of those situations that can get you into a dangerous spot. Plus, they're funny, most of them. I came back to Dallas, and I decided I needed a boyfriend because, well, the one I had was kind of shooting cocaine when I got back, and it's kind of hard to have a relationship with someone who's shooting cocaine when you're trying to be sober. So, but, you know, I'll have to tell you, everybody in Dallas said you're going to have to change that. And I had to come back to Atlanta to talk to my people at the treatment center who really knew and loved me. And they suggested I get rid of him, too. So off he went to a treatment center. And I thought, I need to, you know, I've been gone for 4 months. I need some love and care here. So I went out and found a cute little bartender. I mean, he was wonderful. Didn't work out, but that's what I needed. And so for the first 6 or 8 weeks of my sobriety back in Dallas, I went to the bar every night. Drank Calistoga, stood there at the bar. Despite writing that wonderful relapse stuff, I was right there every night. I do not suggest you do that. But that is my story and that is my history. After that, I met somebody in Alcoholics Anonymous. That was interesting. I guess there kind of was a 13th step there. I think he had 6 months and I had 9 months. And that lasted for a while, 4 or 5 years. But what I've learned about relationships, at least in my life, is I lack honesty. And when the beginning's there, I love that. But when the end is there, I try to blind myself to that. And instead of being honest and saying, this isn't working, and thank you, I tend to do that little overlap game. It's painful. I try not to do it anymore. I went through the steps because I had to. I went through the steps when I was here in the treatment center, by the way. I did that 4th and 5th step, but I had to leave. I mean, it wasn't like a big decision. Do it or you're not going to go home. And I was kind of getting lonely. And secondly, I was kind of getting poor. So I thought, okay, we'll do it. I'm really grateful that the first step was done for me. I got here having done the first step. I didn't get all the unmanageability part, but I knew I was powerless. I was beaten. There was a war. I lost. Big deal. I've lost before. Second step was a little more difficult because I was raised Catholic and I had this vengeful, hateful God and I had to get rid of him. My God and I today ride a tandem bicycle. He's in the front, I'm in the back. All I got to do is pedal. He has to know where we're going. He has to keep the balance. He has to keep the speed going. All I got to do is pedal. And when I get tired, I can lift up my feet. He doesn't even know. Doesn't even care. It's much easier that way. In treatment, they just said, there is a God. It is not you. And let's move on to the third step. Once I made the decision to turn my will and life over to God, I haven't taken that decision back. I think people who take that decision back go out and drink again. I sometimes don't like the decision, and I sometimes don't like the care that God takes of me. It's interesting, I can turn over nearly all other parts of my life, but somehow I don't think God can understand the stock market right now, nor is he very good on relationships. So I take those back. And I mess them up every single time I take them back. I did a 4th and a 5th step to leave. I did another one when I came back. Went through one with Jack. I did that with my sponsor simply because he knows me. And when I call him in the middle of the night, and, you know, just start regurgitating as sponsees do. You don't even say hello. You just start. And after about 3 minutes, they go, hello. I'm fine, too. But anyhow, you just start regurgitating to him, and he knows who I am, and he knows all the stuff. And so he says, you know, this sounds like what happened back then, and this sounds like that person's relationship over there, and this sounds like what you've done in the past. And it's so helpful. It just takes a lot of time out of that conversation. You don't have to bother with pleasantries. You don't have to remind him who you are. He knows it all. 6 and 7, I work very regularly. I have character defects that still jump up and slap me in the face all the time. They're better than they used to be. Procrastination was one of my favorites. When I got my medical license, you're supposed to get certified in certain boards, and anesthesia is one of those, and I just was busy. And I just didn't want to do that. And I put that off and put that off and put that off. And finally, Dr. Tom said to me, I did it at 5 years of sobriety. I think you can do it too. And so I went and did that. And you're supposed to pass it on the third time, and I just barely passed it on the third time. And then I had to go take oral exams. I did a little better on those. It was two guys in a hotel room, and I usually do well with oral exams on two guys in a hotel room. Another one was greed, for lack of a better term. Now, of course, it wouldn't manifest itself as greed. It manifests itself as, no, I'll work the extra hours. You go ahead and go on home. I'll do these cases, which just means I'll make more money. And since I was in charge, I could do that. Don't do that anymore. Lust. I could barely sit next to somebody who was cute in an AA meeting. I could barely sit next to them. Until my sponsor finally said to me, why don't you just make a pact with yourself that you're not going to sleep with them today? Once I do that, I can talk to nearly anybody. I still do it too in meetings. When you walk over to that new cute newcomer and see if they need a sponsor, he said you just didn't do that to the 400-pound girl who walked in after him. Why don't you just not do it, you know, treat everybody the same? But it's funny how those character defects masquerade, at least in my life. I really felt like I became part of the human race again when I did steps 8 and 9. I had a lot of amends to make. I had that first one, of course, to the IRS that I had just forgotten to pay them some money. I paid them. It wasn't easy, but I did. My sponsor's sponsor happens to be an accountant. She suggested I write them out a check. I tried to explain it was my money and I should be put on a payment plan. And she asked those horrible words, "Did you have the money?" Yes, paid them. I paid them. My parents, my brothers and sisters. When I moved to Texas, you could buy beer at the gas station. My father gave me a credit card, Shell credit card. That Shell credit card would be $700 and $800 a month. I explained to him that Texas was a really big state and we did a lot of driving. When I finally went back to look at that, I realized I needed to pay them some of that money back. And I did. They wanted some little tiny house somewhere on some little lake, and I just bought it for them. I think it was $15,000. It was nothing. The interesting thing is that the pain went away when I made the first payment on that house. Not the last one. The first payment. My brothers and sisters, I had completely ignored them. Ignored them. Fell off the planet. They worried about me. They loved me. I used to go home for holidays, and when I would go home for the holidays, I heard about this later, a couple years later. They told me that they would have a meeting downstairs in the basement. My mother would lead it, and it would go something like this. Your brother is coming home. Do not piss him off. He will ruin our holidays if you do. So now when I have sponsees say, I have to go home for the holidays, I tell them, well, you know, your parents aren't too thrilled about it either, I can assure you. If you're that happy about it, stay your tired ass at home. Go to an AA meeting. I got to make some amends also to the gay community in general. You know, I had always just thought it was just kind of easy to be gay, and that, you know, people were getting more accepting, and they were getting more accepting because that's just the way it was. And I didn't realize that there's a lot of organizations out there who do a lot of work to help on that. So when I tend to give my donations to certain organizations, I do that because I know that that's helping pay back my community. When HRC calls me, I write them a big check because I have the ability to do that and because I think it's the right thing to do. Because for years, I just took advantage of the gay community. I was never a part of it. Also, the community in my city. I mean, when my neighborhood association has a meeting, they usually have it at my house. It's the easiest place to meet. I'm not riding up and down the street anymore in drag on a motorcycle. Usually not, anyhow. And they know that they can come to me because I usually say yes. Because it's about coming back into the human race and about being a person again. I get to grow up a lot on step 10. I get to practice being an adult. You know, it's a bitch growing up in public. But that's what AA forces us to do. And so I get to go out there and do something, and then at the end of the day, look at it and go, that wasn't too good. I have to work on that a little bit. But I don't beat myself up. I just try it again the next day. It works well for me. I do step 11 a lot. I pray every morning. I get to drive over that lake every day, back to that hospital that I came out of, back to that hospital that they took my stuff out of my locker and handed it to me in a cardboard box. That walk of shame out the door. 10 years later, they voted me Physician of the Year at that little hospital. My boyfriend went with me to get the award. They've come a long way since I've been sober. And I get to do that meditation every morning. I get to walk, drive out there, and the sun is coming up, and I get to say, thank you for the gift. I cannot tell you every day I like the gift. You know, if they want what we have, I'm willing to go to any lengths. When I have to go do things, service work that I don't really care to do, or it's not convenient, or I have people call me at weird hours of the night, or I have to go to meetings and set up chairs and make coffee and get birthday cakes and find speakers. You know what? That wasn't one of the options. Service work to me is epitomized in the word yes. I've done lots of service work because I was told I had to, and because other people did it before me. I feel good when I do service work. I really do. I participated at the national level and the international level and the local level. And I've loved every bit of it because Alcoholics Anonymous has always been there for me. It's been there for you too. Someone has to do it, and I guess it's just my turn. And I'll just take my turn and then sit down like everybody else. I used to have this huge sense of entitlement. I don't know where that came from. Today, I realize that a lot of the privileges I have in my life have responsibilities that go with them. And I don't shirk on those responsibilities because I sure do enjoy the privilege. There were some times that Alcoholics Anonymous got a little difficult. Years 6 through 9 were not pleasant. My friend Marie calls them the desert years. Because you feel like you're out there by yourself. You look around at meetings and no one's 6 or 7 or 8 or 9. I don't know where they go. I guess they could go to other meetings. I guess they could go to another city. I guess they could just stop going and come back. But you just stick around and you stay there. And you have people who, you know, if I don't show up at a meeting in a week, my sponsor drives his little Sherman tank over to my house and throws me in the back and off we go. You know, we go to all kinds of meetings. I go to gay meetings. I go to straight meetings. Early on, my sponsor told me, I heard your four-step. You know a lot about being gay. You don't know a lot about staying sober. I suggest you come with me now. We're going to go someplace new. We're going to go someplace where you can sit in the back, relax, and not have to look at every single person that comes in the door. Got that one. I think it's about ready for me to time for me to sit down. And before I do, I'd like to tell you a little story. It's a story that that I like to end with because it epitomizes for me what Alcoholics Anonymous does and is. My friend Helen T. told it the first time I heard it. She was on the General Service Board, and a wonderful woman who worked for Alcoholics Anonymous for many years. And it's about a wise man, and the wise man asked God to show him his version of heaven and hell. So God leads him down a corridor, and at the corridor there's two doors. And the wise man picks one of the doors and walks in. And in this room, there's a big round table, and there's all these people sitting around the table. And they're emaciated, and they're angry, and they're fighting with each other. And sitting in the middle of this table is this big bowl of stew, hot and aromatic. And each of these people at the table have this curious long-handled spoon in their hands. It's attached to their hands. They can't get it off. And it's so long that although they can reach it to the stew, they can't get it back to their mouth. And God says to the wise men, this is hell. So they go back out into the hallway and they open the other door. And in the other door, there's a big round table with a big bowl of stew. But these people are well fed and they're happy and they're laughing and they're smoking and they're just enjoying themselves. And yet on each of their hands is still fashioned this curious long-handled spoon. They can still get to the stew, but they can't get it back to their mouth. And the wise man says, I don't understand. And God says, you see, in this room they've learned to feed each other. Because that's what Alcoholics Anonymous is. You know, if I have a bad day and I go to an AA meeting, the chances of all of you having a bad day are pretty small. But if I don't come here, I'll never find that out. And that's one of the reasons I keep coming back. I come back to share my experience, strength, and hope, and hear your experience, strength, and hope. We all get to share it back and forth. It is the largest outpatient clinic in the world. It truly is. Where can you get such great help for $1? That's why I come to Alcoholics Anonymous, because it has given me back my life. And I thank you for that. Great roundup. Thanks for all your work and all your help.
Thank you, Michael. We appreciate you coming all the way to Atlanta. Thanks for your story. And thanks for your calls and words of encouragement the whole year out about the roundup. I really appreciate that. With that, we'll bring Debbie up to do the promises.